Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 107 of Mystic Sheet Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. So first of all, I'd like to welcome all you to part two, episode number 107 of my 60 Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, or Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is, I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 60 music fan slash expert slash turn. Each week of this podcast, I take one song by one artist in the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part of the show, talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, and then do my own personal analysis on the range of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics, and then the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. And that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, who are the musicians on the track, whether it be the band members or the studio musicians themselves, the history behind the band that recorded it, the group that recorded it, the artist that recorded it, or the duo that recorded it, and the producer, the people that wrote it, and what studio the song was recorded at, where that studio was located at, and the name of the song was released on, where that label is located, and the history behind that record label, and the year and month the song was released, and the peak position the song made up when it was originally released, and what peak position it made up on the Billboard Hot 100 charts when it first came out. All that is in the second part of the show. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's song. And look, we got a lot to talk about this week. There's three things we're going to talk about, you know, in this episode of this podcast that are kind of in depth. So, again, if this episode goes a little bit longer than usual, I apologize. But again, this is a lot of in-depth things going on with not only the genre the song falls into, but also the history behind the artists that recorded the song and the musicians who are playing on it. So there's a lot of stuff we got to talk about in here. So the first thing we're going to talk about is psychedelic rock, and then we'll get to the history behind this band, Kenny Rogers and the First Nation, and we'll talk a little bit about the Wrecking Crew. And I'll say that for a little bit later. But first, let's talk about the history behind psychedelic rock, because again, you know, when people think of 60s music, they automatically gravitate towards psychedelic rock. It's almost like the stereotyped caricature of 60s music, you know, because people, you know, when they think about, you know, the Laurel Canyon music scene with Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Monkees, and, you know, and they automatically gravitate towards psychedelic rock because that music was very much a part of that scene. And again, like, you know, that's basically the psychedelic rock is essentially the stereotype of 60s music. And, it, you know, and when you think of psychedelic rock, you think of bands like, you know, Jimi Hendrix Experience, Jefferson Airplane and the Doors, and just the bands that fall into that category of very stereotypical 60s songs. But like I was kind of hinting at earlier last week, you know, psychedelic rock was only around for pretty much the later half of the 60s. It didn't really exist in the early 60s. And you got to think about that for a minute, because if you think to yourself, okay, so if psychedelic rock wasn't around in the early 60s, then what was around at that time? Well, that's what I was getting at with last week, because I was trying to hint to you guys that, look, psychedelic rock was only a very small portion of popular music from that time frame. There was so much other stuff other than psychedelic rock, you know, from the 60s. And I want to show you guys some other songs from other genres from that time too, like the Teen Idols and the British Invasion and the Brill Building and Motown and Southern Soul and Chicago Soul and Philly Soul and, you know, all these different subgenres of 60s music. I kind of wanted to show you guys within this podcast. That's really what I've been done over the past 100 episodes I've done of the show. So I feel like I've done a pretty good job of that. But now, kind of want to get into psychedelic rock, because like I said just a couple minutes ago, this genre of music wasn't really around in the early 60s. And one might wonder exactly why it wasn't. Well, one thing I wanted to talk with you guys about, and this kind of ties in with, this is more of a general 60s thing, but totally ties in with the psychedelic rock, is that we really have to talk about the difference between early 60s and mid and late 60s. Because in the early 60s, again, it was before the British Invasion, hardly any bands were on the charts. But at the same time, the musical landscape of what was on the radio, on Top 40 radio, in the early 60s, it was very innocent music. I mean, when you listen to a lot of stuff from the early 60s, and I'm talking like Dion, Neil Sedaka, Del Shannon, Paul Anka, a lot of those teen idols, and, you know, all that stuff, you know, you're not going to really, the first thing is that's going to come to your mind, it's not going to be drugs, you know, because you're not going to think of drugs when you hear these songs at all. They're very innocent love songs that dealt with, you know, romantic relationships, and drugs was very, very far away from all of those songs that you heard on Top 40 radio in the early 60s by, you know, Leslie Gore and Gene Pitney and the Drifters and all that, all those Brill Building songs. You never really heard drugs, or you never really thought of drugs when you listened to those songs. And one makes you think, okay, so how do we get from those really innocent love songs from the early 60s, you know, like Rhythm of the Rain by the Cascades and Go Away Little Girl by Steve Lawrence, how do we get from those really innocent love songs to the really heavy psychedelic rock in the late 60s? Well, to kind of help you sort of bridge the gap between those two, let's talk about what happened with the Beatles and the Beach Boys. Because if you think about it, I'm just going to give you some historical perspective. The whole genre of psychedelic rock really all got started in the middle 60s, right? Because if you think about it, the British invasion happened. I talked about that. You know, all these British bands invaded the charts. And, you know, for the most part, a lot of these songs that were coming out of the British invasion sort of carried on the whole traditional love song thing that was going on in the early 60s, but it was more of an updated version of that, with more interesting chord changes and more of a contained, self-contained band kind of arrangements that were happening in, you know, the British invasion. And this happened with the Searchers and Billy J. Cream and the Dakotas and Jerry and the Pacemakers. But when did people really start to think of drugs, when they started to listen to rock music? Because again, like rock music of the early 60s, I mean, it was all like 12-bar blues, you know, just kind of fun, happy songs. I mean, like Tossing and Turning by Bobby Lewis, and even some of the New Orleans stuff like Oop Oop A Doop by Jesse Hill, and some of that Fats Domino's music. And again, a lot of those British invasion bands covered songs like that. I mean, the Dave Clark Five is a great example of that. But again, when you heard the Dave Clark Five and you heard a lot of these bands, you never really thought of drugs when you listened to these songs. So if you think about it, how did drugs all of a sudden wind up in the psyche of, you know, these of rock music? Well, it all got started really in 1965, when both the Beatles and the Beach Boys simultaneously started to experiment with drugs when they were starting to record their music. And there were two albums made by both of those bands that, when people listened to them, they started to finally realize that, you know, there was something different about these songs. They were innocent love songs, but they were way more complex musically, and something else was going on within, you know, the arrangements of these songs and the productions of these songs, that some people began to think, okay, something must be happening when they were writing and recording these songs that created such a weird, different kind of a sound with these records. And, you know, and those two albums were Rubber Soul and Pet Sounds. Rubber Soul came out obviously before Pet Sounds, a little bit before Pet Sounds. But the point I'm trying to make is that both the tracks on both of those albums signaled as to what when people started to think of drugs, when they started to hear rock music, both those songs kind of signaled a lot of those things. And then all of a sudden, you know, with the Beatles experimenting with that already, with, you know, songs like Think for Yourself, which had that distorted bass, you know, and also Norwegian Wood, which was actually one of the first songs to have a sitar on that record, an Indian sitar. And again, a lot of this happened because, you know, those two bands were starting to become curious about some of the Indian music. And that's one thing I kind of forgot to mention to you last week, was that one very strong characteristic of psychedelic rock was that Indian sitar thing. I know it's kind of stereotypical, but it's so true, because, you know, the Beach Boys and the Beatles were starting to hear a lot of, you know, different atonal things from Indian music, and they were thought, maybe we can kind of incorporate some of that sound into our music. And that's really what they did, you know. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, the Beach Boys actually spent, quite a lot of time in India, and Mike Love was there, and so was Peter Fonda, and so were a couple other, Mia Farrow was there, and a couple other major celebrities. And from that trip, they probably were experimenting with a lot of psychedelic drugs, and because of that, you know, that a lot of that creeped into a lot of their music. And this was true in a lot of songs off of Pet Sounds. You know, songs like You Still Believe in Me kind of went into that direction. Even the title track off the album, which was called Pet Sounds, again, leaned into more of that psychedelic rock kind of direction. And all that kind of went to a boiling point with the Beach Boys with Good Vibrations in 1966. That was really the beginning of that. But aside from the Beatles and the Beach Boys, there was one other British group and one other American group that, again, was getting into that Ravi Shankar, you know, Indian sitar sound, and that, you know, and again, a lot of psychedelic rock was also if you kind of go before the genre sort of came to be in the mid 60s, you could say that there was a lot of jazz music that came out in the early 60s really hinted to that, because it's kind of true that the first musicians to really experiment with LSD and some of these psychedelic drugs were in fact jazz musicians. They were the first ones to really experiment with that, with psychedelic drugs before the rock musicians did. And that is so true. And a lot of music like by the artists like John Coltrane also had hints to that sort of psychedelic vibe. But anyways, so the British band and the American band, the first, they both put out singles kind of simultaneously. You know, they both these songs came out literally at the exact same time and were recorded at the exact same time. And they were both recorded again within the same time frame as Rubber Soul and Pet Sounds, like literally within the exact same time frame. And both of those songs were Shapes of Things and 8 Miles High. And Shapes of Things was by the Yardbirds, and 8 Miles High was by the Byrds. And Shapes of Things, again, was it was actually the first original song that the Yardbirds recorded, you know, that they wrote. I mean, they were recording songs by Graham Goldman before that, but that was the first song that they wrote. And it was kind of meant to be a pro-environmental, message within the song's lyrics. But again, a lot of people really had a hard time understanding that message. So a lot of times people were thinking, okay, the songs may be about drugs. And that's when they heard when they listened to that song on AM radio for the first time within that early 66 time frame, and when the song was recorded in like late 1965. And again, that's basically what the song was about, sort of anti-war, pro-environmentalism. That was the main theme of that song. And, you know, that was what the lyrics were about. But again, people had a hard time deciphering that. So a lot of times people thought that was about drugs. And 8 Miles High was kind of a similar thing because, you know, Roger McGuinn, who was in the Byrds, he really got into Ravi Shankar around this time, and John Coltrane. So both those things influenced that really weird, you know, just strange solo that was in 8 Miles High. You know, which was influenced by both of those things, more the solo he played on his 12-string Rickenbacker guitar. And again, that song was not about drugs, mind you. It was actually about their first, international tour when they went to England, you know, in 1965. But again, the whole 8 Miles High title, obviously that people thought it was about drugs because, you know, 8 Miles High, people there, they thought they were about getting high instead of, you know, but really the title 8 Miles High was just a reference of how high they were off the ground when they were landing to England, when the plane that they were flying in. That's basically what the title means. It was a reference to how high they were off the ground as far as elevation is concerned when they were landing their plane in England doing their first international tour. And that's basically what the song was about. It was all about the band's first impression of England and how that whole thing went, and how they got sued by another band called the Byrds, you know, an English band that had the same name as them, just a different spelling, but that's a whole nother story. But yeah, I mean, both those songs were recorded in late 1965 and were released in January, February of 1966, and made the charts really March, April of that year. And they really kind of came on the charts at the exact same time. So, you know, they were on the charts like April, May of that year. And when people first heard those songs, that's when people really started to think of psychedelic rock, because they were thinking to themselves, maybe these songs are about drugs, because I can't understand the words to them. I can't comprehend what these songs are about lyrically. And some of the, you know, the weird things happening with the song, you know, like the effects on Shapes of Things, because there's a lot of, you know, signature psychedelic rock things happening with the guitar effects in the song. Specifically, the fuzz tone, you know, in that song is very, very psychedelic rock. And some of that, and that weird section in the middle where there were, it was this weird backward solo happening, this double track solo that was recorded by Jeff Beck, you know, for Shapes of Things. Again, that made people think maybe the song's about drugs. And again, it was the fact that the combination of the drugged out guitar effects and the fact that people really couldn't understand what these songs were about lyrically made people think, maybe these songs were about drugs, even though clearly they weren't, you know. But again, that's when psychedelic rock kind of came to be around this time. And even before that, like, let's just take a couple months before that. Those are two really well-known examples of the beginning of psychedelic rock. But, you know, a not-so-well-known example, which, again, literally the pretty much exact same time, but, again, this was more of a regional hit. This was actually more of a garage rock band that was one of the first experiment with psychedelic rock. And I can tell you that when they recorded the song, you know, the singer was high out of his mind when he recorded the vocals for the song. So there definitely was drugs, and so was the whole band. The whole band was on LSD when they recorded the song. And, you know, basically that drug overtook them, and you can hear that when you're listening to the song, because again, it's so crazy and so weird. And even though, yeah, it's kind of a breakup song, but you can hear the psychedelics happening within the music of the song and some of the instrumentation too. And that song was You're Gonna Miss Me, and that song was by a local Texas band called the 13th Floor Elevators, and the lead singer of that band was Rocky Erickson. And again, it was a song written by him, but again, the whole band was on LSD when they recorded that song, so they were high out of their minds. And again, but the thing is about that song is that wasn't a national top 40 hit. That was only a regional hit. Remember why I talked about regional hits? Songs that basically, you know, were only hits in certain parts of the country, but not nationally, not everywhere. That song peaked at, I believe, number 55 in January, February of 66 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. But again, that was a national hit. But again, that was really the beginning of psychedelic rock. And that was more of a lesser known sort of local top 40 version of that. But the bigger, most well-known examples of that were, again, the Byrds' 8 Miles High and the Yardbirds' Shapes of Things. Both those things weren't really about drugs, but 13th Floor Elevators, You're Gonna Miss Me, even though it's a breakup song, it doesn't necessarily have to do with drugs lyrically. They were high out of their minds when they recorded it in Texas at that time, you know. So again, that those are two really good examples of that. So that was kind of the beginning of that whole psychedelic rock movement of the late 60s, were those three songs. Okay, so just a quick little FYI before I move on with this podcast. The Beatles and the Beach Boys, before they started really experimenting with, you know, psychedelics with their music, you know, both with debuting with Rubber Soul and Pet Sounds, before that, they were mainly doing, like, very innocent love songs. I mean, they weren't, you didn't really think of drugs when you heard a lot of their earlier stuff. But again, like, you know, right around the same time, they really started experimenting with psychedelic drugs, and that was showing a lot of their songs from both Rubber Soul and Pet Sounds. And yeah, so just a quick little timeline. Okay, so, you know, within that 1 year period of 66, you had, like I mentioned earlier, Pet Sounds and Rubber Soul, and you had 8 Miles High and the Yardbird song Shape of Things. But then after that, you had Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, and you had Revolver by the Beatles. And this is when really psychedelic drugs were starting to, you know, really creep into people's subconsciousness, or, you know, the psychedelic rock. You know, like, for example, I mean, one song that Paul McCartney literally blatantly admitted was about weed, actually, was Got to Get You in My Life. You know, because he blatantly admitted that, hey, the song isn't about love. It's this song is about my love for a woman. It's about my love for weed, actually. And then people were like, oh my God, like, I can't believe, like, he was thinking about drugs when he wrote that song. And, you know, this happened, you know, especially with Good Vibrations, because Good Vibrations, that song was so weird, because it was literally, it felt like three songs in one. And again, that's when, and Brian Wilson was starting to experiment with psychedelic drugs around that time too. And that a lot of that showed up within Good Vibrations. Because again, like he, you know, when he was starting to, you know, he was starting to hallucinate and he was starting to see and hear things, you know, he, Mike Love brought up the observation that, you know, dogs like to pick up, you know, good vibrations from people, or they can pick up bad vibrations from people whenever they interact with them. And that inspired him to write that song. Well, that's a whole nother story. But yeah. So with those two things happening all at the same time, you know, and by the way, that would reach a boiling point with a year later with the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper. But on with other bands also experimenting with this at the same time, you had a group called the Blues Magoos. Now, the Blues Magoos were the first ever band to actually have put out a record, a full length album with the term title psychedelic in it, or the term psychedelic in it. And that album was called Psychedelic Lollipop. And basically, that album came out in late 1966, and that had, quite honestly, could be one of the first quintessential psychedelic rock songs, called We Ain't Got Nothing Yet. And that album actually did okay, but that was like their one hit song. But some of the other songs, and again, this was all late 66, early 67, just a year, really into the year 66 and the beginning of 67, and that song came out. But some of the other songs really also, you know, heightened those psychedelic tensions, you know, and those songs included Pipe Dream and their version of Tobacco Road. But again, like, this all kind of happened within, you know, late 65, early 66, and then into late 66, early 67. And through 67, that's when the genre blew up, because then you had Jefferson Airplane with Somebody Loving White Rabbit. And then by the summer of 67, you had to Light My Fire by the Doors. And then that's when psychedelic rock just blew up. That's when people really started to, that's when the musicians who were kind of experimenting with drugs and were starting to write more fierce, philosophical, weird lyrics with their songs. And that's when the, you know, and started to show up into basically in the pop songs, you know, like Somebody Love, for instance. You know, and also, you know, you started to hear more fuzz tone wah-wah guitar effects on records like in With Somebody You Love, and you started to hear more of that Vox Continental Farfisa compact organ sound more, given more prominence. And that was with The Doors, Light My Fire, which again is a really good example of that, because there's a lot of weird harmonic things going on with that song. There's a minor five chord in there, and there's a bunch of weird changes happening. Really good example of that. And Somebody Love is another good example of a minor key psychedelic rock song, like I was talking to you about, guys, last week. Another really good example of that. But again, all these songs were, you know, once the Summer of Love happened in 1967 and the Haight-Ashbury movement was in full swing and the Monterey Pop Festival was going on, that's when psychedelic rock music was at its zenith. And there was soon to be a British version of psychedelic rock happening, you know, kind of coinciding with what was going on in America. And the groups that were kind of, you know, at the height of all that were, in fact, the Jimi Hendrix Experience and Cream. Both those groups kind of represented the sort of British version of psychedelic rock that was also hitting American airwaves. And this also kind of came at an interesting time in pop music, because at this time the songs were getting longer. So that meant that, yeah, I mean, some songs, you know, obviously, you know, there were long songs, but the shortened version was played for AM radio. But that also meant that FM radio stations were starting to come in, and FM radio stations didn't have to worry about playing really short songs. They could play songs as long as they wanted, the songs that were as long as there's a heart desires. They didn't have to worry about length. They could play like super long songs, you know, because they weren't, you know, again, like entirely, you know, FCC enforced like the AM radio stations were. So they could really play super long songs. And that's when psychedelic rock music came to be. And it just got insane, you know, once 67 turned to 68, because then you heard songs like Inagada Vida by Iron Butterfly, which is a 17-minute song, and then he heard Chambers Brothers' Time Has Come Today, which was like a 12-minute song. And again, a lot of these songs, again, they were either innocent love songs, but really, really psychedelic instrumentation, fuzz tone guitar, very much of an emphasis on the instrumentation, not so much on the vocals. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of emphasis on the vocals, but again, some of these songs had super long guitar solos and organ solos and, you know, very, very long songs that weren't super short like a lot of what was happening in the early 60s. So, again, this really represented the change from early 60s to mid to late 60s. That's when psychedelic rock really came to be, was in the late 60s. And essentially, again, this represented like we weren't in 1963 anymore or 1962. This was a totally different time frame of the 60s. I mean, but again, like I said before, when psychedelic rock was blowing up in the late 60s, at the same time, you also heard, you know, harder R&B soul like Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding and a lot of the stuff coming from Stax Records, you know, and, you know, like, for example, Who's Making Love by John Taylor, great example of that. So, and you also heard some of the more bubblegummy pop songs like Ohio Express and 1910 Fruit Gum Company and even some more other stuff like the Cow Sills and, you know, the Association and a lot of these other more poppier songs. So again, you know, when all the really heavy music was happening, a lot of the other more not so heavy, lighter bubblegummy stuff was also on the radio at the same time, like with songs by the Grassroots. So again, you know, there was always sort of like in the late 60s when psychedelic rock was huge, there was always a contrast between that and the more lighter bubblegum pop stuff from, you know, the late 60s, you know, like the Cow Sills and 1910 Fruit Gum Company and Ohio Express and all the other stuff. Again, that was all happening right at the same time as the more heavy psychedelic rock music. So again, there was always that contrast between those two things. But, you know, when musicians really started experimenting with drugs, you know, that's when psychedelic rock became the beat. And that really didn't happen in the early 60s, with the exception of jazz musicians who were really experimenting within the 50s, as early as that. But that really showed up in the early 60s, though. But again, that's just my point about that. Okay, so now that, like I said before, like, you know, once the psychedelic rock music happened in the late 60s, we were out of the early 60s, we were out of the 2-minute, you know, 3-minute song that was standard for AM radio in the early 60s, and we're now moving in the 12-minute, 17-minute, really hard psychedelic rock songs that were a far cry from the very innocent, sappy love songs of the early 60s. Again, these were very experimental, very weird lyrics, sometimes with a hidden message behind them, a lot of times very, you know, strange lyrics. Again, we were kind of moving away from that into the psychedelic rock era. So just the thing to keep in mind when you have conversations with people about 60s music, you always kind of want to make the distinction between the early 60s and the late 60s. And the big distinction is that psychedelic rock came about in the late 60s, but not in the early 60s. Okay, so now let's talk about the history behind Kenny Rogers and the First Edition. Okay, so I'm sure you probably knew that I said the name Kenny Rogers. Yeah, this was his band before he became a country artist. But let's talk about that for a minute, because that's kind of interesting. Because I'm sure when you listen to last week's song, you're like, holy shit, that's Kenny Rogers, the gambler Kenny Rogers? You know, the guy who sang that song, "You Picked a Fine Time to Leave Me, Lucille," that guy? He's doing this psychedelic rock song? Like, what is he doing diving into this genre of music? I always thought he only did country music. Well, if you thought that he was only a country guy and that's all he did throughout his entire career as a professional musician, boy, you have another thing coming, because this is going to surprise you for a minute. Because way before he was doing that, you know, this the band that he was in, the First Edition, you know, country music wasn't even on their minds in the beginning. But this is the interesting thing about, you know, this band, Kenny Rogers and the First Edition, is that, yes, it was Kenny Rogers' band, but in the beginning, they weren't trying to be a country music band. They weren't trying to sound like, you know, the current country artists of that time. You know, in the beginning, you know, their backgrounds weren't even really in country. In fact, their backgrounds were actually in folk music. Okay, so I know what you're going to say, Sam. What are you talking about? You know, Kenny Rogers is a folk musician before he did country? Okay, I'm going to explain to you about that in just a few minutes. Okay, so Kenny Rogers in the first edition, Kenny Rogers and pretty much all the members of the band, with the exception of Mickey Jones, were all members of a huge, huge folk band. And I'm not just saying they were huge in popularity, but they were huge in terms of size, too, because there were a lot of people in this group at the same time. Kenny Rogers in the first edition, the members of the band, they were all members of this folk band, you know, called the New Christy Minstrels. And the New Christy Minstrels very much represented the whole sort of folk hootenanny movement of the early 60s, which dominated AM radio in like 1963 and 62. I mean, this was started with like Peter Paul and Mary and Bob Dylan. And that was really the beginning of that. Well, the New Christy Minstrels were around that time. And again, they were kind of with the Rooftop Singers and the Serendipity Singers, very the folk hootenanny thing, which kind of really went away in, you know, once the British invasion happened and later moved on to folk rock, but that's a whole nother story. But anyways, Kenny Rogers in the first edition, you know, all the guys in the band were members of the New Christy Minstrels. And by this time, the New Christy Minstrels was kind of, you know, they were not doing well. In fact, a lot of the members of the what would become the first edition with Kenny Rogers, they all felt like they were being screwed by by the New Christy Minstrels, because they felt like they weren't getting paid their due royalties that they were that they felt like they needed to survive when they were in the New Christy Minstrels. So, you know, because of that, they all decided to leave the band. And by the way, just to allow you to get to know this group, the first edition, the core members of this band, you know, in the beginning were Kenny Rogers on bass and guitar and Mike Settle on rhythm guitar and Terry Williams on lead guitar and Mickey Jones on drums. And they actually had a female singer named Thelma Camacho, you know, who actually sang with them on a lot of their country songs, but not so much in the beginning. But anyways, you know, they all kind of collectively came together in 1967 because they felt like, you know, they didn't really want to be the New Christy Minstrels anymore because they felt like they were kind of shifted by them. And basically were like, okay, let's try to form a new group, because I feel like we could really basically form a new group that sounds different than our previous group, you know, which was, you know, the New Christy Minstrels. And we're all really, really good singers. Let's see if we can kind of form our own group and see if we can do something a little bit different than what everybody else is doing. And basically, that's kind of what happened. Is that they all knew each other. They were all in the same band, the New Christy Minstrels, and they all decided that, you know, they wanted to form a new band and basically have every member trade lead vocals, because they were all really, really good lead singers. Kenny Rogers was a good lead singer, and Mike Settle was a good lead singer, and Terry Williams is a good lead singer, and I think Mickey Jones could sing too, but those were the main guys in the band that were really good singers. And interestingly enough, you know, they were all New Christy Minstrels except for Mickey Jones, because Mickey Jones had a slightly more different background. Mickey Jones at the time, you know, it was before he became an actor, he was basically a professional musician living in L.A. playing drums for the likes of Trini Lopez and Johnny Rivers. He played on all of Trini Lopez's earlier hits, like If I Had a Hammer and his version of Kansas City. And then he all played on pretty much all the early Johnny Rivers hits, all the stuff he recorded at the Whiskey Go. I'm talking like Memphis. I'm talking, Maybelline and, you know, Seven Sun and Secret Agent Man, all those really early, all those early Whiskey A Go-Go songs that Johnny Rivers recorded over there at that club in L.A., Mickey Jones played drums in all those tracks. And he basically came in after he had just got finished doing a tour with Bob Dylan in 1967. And he basically, you know, he came back because he wanted to kind of join a band. And essentially, he became the main drummer for the group. Now, interestingly enough, this band actually got signed to Reprise Records. Now, Reprise Records, if you don't know anything about that label, here's the gist of basically what that label is about. The label was owned and controlled and basically formed by Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra, it was basically, he formed the label when he was just starting to get back into the, you know, into the popular end of the music business. I mean, he just had a huge hit with Strangers of the Night, and then he would have more hits with That's Life, and he also would have another hit with his daughter, Nancy Sinatra, with what was that song by them? Something Stupid, right? It was that song. And essentially, you know, Frank Sinatra started the label when he really wanted to get back into the music business after being out of it for so long because of the British invasion. And, you know, he started that label specifically just for Nancy's, for his daughter, Nancy Sinatra, to record, you know, her songs with Lee Hazlewood producing. But then he kind of expanded it and started to sign other artists as well. And the first psychedelic rock band they signed to label was the Electric Prunes, but the second psychedelic rock band they signed was this band, Kenny Rogers, in the First Edition. How they got signed to label is that Terry Williams, the guy who was in the band, his mom, you know, worked for a record executive at Reprise Records. His name was Jimmy Bowen. And basically, you know, she arranged an audition, with the group, to audition for Jimmy Bowen. And basically, he had the band record demo tapes after they did an audition with Jimmy Bowen. And basically that's when he set the band up with Mike Post. And Mike Post, this was before he did all those famous TV show themes like the Rockford Files and Hill Street Blues. This is before he did all of that. At the time, he was just a producer, you know, working in L.A., working with the Wrecking Crew, and he was mainly just a guy who would also produce a year later after Kenny Rogers and the First Edition did record Just Dropped In. He later on produced Mason Williams' Classical Gas, another huge hit in the summer of 1968. But yeah, so they set him up with Mike Post, and then that's when the First Edition really started to work together, really started to work together really well. And basically, this is when they recorded Just Dropped In, See What My Condition Is In. But okay, let's talk about the origins behind that song. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind the song Just Dropped In, See What Condition My Condition Is In. Let's talk about the guy who wrote it, because the guy who wrote the song, you might not know who he is, and I'm not gonna go into super in-depth detail about his history, but his name is Mickey Newberry, and I'm pretty sure this was the only hit song that he wrote in the pop market. But the main thing to keep in mind about Mickey Newberry is that he was a Nashville-based, primarily country songwriter. Now, which meant that he was affiliated with many different Music City musicians and songwriters, and these people included Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, even Elvis too, and a lot of different people who were within that scene in the 60s and 70s, Jerry Kennedy, a lot of Kris Kristofferson, a lot of those people. He was involved in the careers of a lot of those musicians, you know, and within the Nashville music scene of that time frame, you know. So again, like, he was in a nutshell, he was a Nashville based songwriter, and this was probably his first entry into the psychedelic rock field. And I think his original message of the song, the song was written by him as kind of a warning to the people who were thinking about experimenting with LSD, and just sort of a warning to people who, you know, just to let people know in advance what might be some of the bad consequences of experimenting with LSD at that time, for people who were thinking about experimenting with LSD / acid in that time frame of the late 60s. But as you can kind of imagine, I mean, you know, with this song, right, you can kind of hear that the first Kenny Rogers and the First Edition weren't the first to record the song, and that is absolutely true, because the first version of the song, and I must warn you, it's completely different from the hit version by Kenny Rogers and the First Edition. The first recorded version of the song was not by Kenny Rogers in the First Edition, but by 50s rock and roller Jerry Lee Lewis. Yeah, that's right. He recorded the song first. And originally, Kenny Rogers first heard the song, because before he came out to L.A., Kenny Rogers was living in Texas, and Mickey Newberry was a friend of his. So he was the one who brought the song, just dropped into the band. You know, Kenny Rogers was the one responsible for bringing the song to the forefront, because he actually had a copy of the original Jerry Lee Lewis album, which had his version of the song on it. And Kenny Rogers was the one who brought Mike Post the song that was written by his friend Mickey Newberry, who at the time was living in Nashville. And again, like, the whole country aspect of Mickey Newberry as a songwriter really creep in with Kenny Rogers a little bit later. But before we get into the history behind the recording session of the song, let's play a little bit of what the song sounded like originally before Kenny Rogers in the first edition recorded it. And again, completely different from the hit version, but let's just hear a little bit of what, you know, when people first heard the song, when it was recorded by 50s rock and roller Jerry Lee Lewis, when he was trying to get into country music in the late 60s. But again, you know, this is kind of what the song sounded like before the first edition got a hold of it.
I jumped up this morning with the sun down shining in. Found my broken mind in a brown paper bag within. I tripped on a cloud, I fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition was in.
Talk about different. I mean, holy mackerel. That was not even remotely close to the same song that Kenny Rogers in the first edition recorded. First of all, you know, the original version by Jerry Lee Lewis sounds more like a not psychedelic rock, but more sort of almost kind of like, you know, soul-ish, more like not necessarily country, but more like, you know, rock and roll soul, you know. But again, like, very, very different from, you know, the Kenny Rogers in the first edition version. And one thing that the Kenny Rogers in the first edition, this band added onto the song when they recorded, is that they actually, the one thing it did that was different from all the other versions of the songs before their version was that they kept changing the key. You know, all the other versions, they stay in the same key. Mickey Newberry's version of the song, which I've heard, by the way, it has all the psychedelic elements. It's not like Jerry Lee Lewis's version. It's more psychedelic. You know, it stays in G minor the entire time. Jerry Lee Lewis's version, you know, he stays in D minor throughout the entire song. It doesn't change keys. Kenny Rogers in the first edition's version, they actually change keys. They go from D minor to E flat minor and E minor all throughout the whole song. So that's one thing they added to the song. Plus those weird sort of transitional chord progressions happening between each key change. But that's a whole nother thing. That's another point. But anyways, so let's talk about the production behind the song and sort of the things that went down when the band was producing the song, and, you know, sort of the in first. Let's also talk about who are the musicians on the song, because, you know, one thing that might surprise you is that the musicians on this band were not on this record were not members of the first edition, but actually members of the Wrecking Crew. Okay, so just a quick little FYI on, you know, the basic behind-the-scenes information about the recording session for the song. The song was recorded in a very interesting studio that I don't really know much about, to be honest with you, but it is interesting that it was recorded in a studio, because this was an LA session, right? And it was recorded in Los Angeles, but it wasn't recorded in a Hollywood studio. Now, this is very interesting, because if you think about it, 90% of the hits that came out of L.A. in the 60s and even in the late 50s, too, most of them are recorded in Hollywood. Most of them are recorded over the hill somewhere in Hollywood in that specific area. I mean, all the major studios were located over there. But it's very interesting how this song wasn't recorded in Hollywood, but it was actually recorded in the Valley. Yeah, that's right. It was engineered by a guy named Jimmy Valentine and recorded at his studio, which was called Valentine Recording Studios, which was located in Valley Village. Yeah, I don't know what other hits came out of that studio or who else recorded there, but That's where the song was recorded. It was done at Valentine Recording Studios, which was located in Valley Village, which is very interesting considering most, you know, big hits that came out of the 60s that were recorded in L.A. were done at Hollywood Studios. Very interesting how that song was recorded in the Valley. There was one other big Valley studio around at the same time called American Recorders, which was based in Studio City. And that's where all the big Three Dog Night hits came out of, and also all the big Steppenwolf hits are recorded in that studio. But again, that studio started out in Hollywood. It wasn't originally a Valley recording studio. But again, that was probably one of the very few big hit songs that came out of the San Fernando Valley that was recorded there. So the song was produced by Mike Post. And here's the main thing to keep in mind about this single, is that Terry Williams, who was a member of the first edition with Kenny Rogers, he was the only member of the band to play on the session. All the other musicians on Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In were members of the Wrecking Crew. Now, I've talked about the Wrecking Crew on this show before, but just in case you don't remember, they were the number one studio group in Los Angeles in the 60s. There was this really core tight group of studio musicians who played on all the major LA hits from The Association, The Mamas and Papas, Fifth Dimension, Johnny Rivers, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Nancy Sinatra, The Beach Boys. I mean, they were on all of those hit records at that time. And it was a whole conglomerate of studio musicians who, you know, most of the time it was like two drummers to play at most of the hits and like six or seven guitar players, three or four piano players, you know, a good like four or five bass players, and a good amount of percussionists too, and horn players. Again, there was essentially this core group of session musicians who played on 90% of the hit output that was being recorded in Los Angeles at that time. I mean, they were used by guys like producers like Phil Spector and Jimmy Bowen and, you know, Snuff Garrett, and just tons of Brian Wilson. They were used by tons of LA producers, and I won't go into too much detail about them other than that, but I just want to let you know that these were in fact the musicians on Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In. And the guys on the record actually were, check this out. So the musicians were, the only band member of the first edition to play on this was Terry Williams. But the other musicians on there were Glenn Campbell on guitar before he was the solo artist, Glenn Campbell, and Mike Deasy on guitar, and David Cohen on guitar, and Joe Osborne on bass, and Hal Blaine on drums. Now, here's the thing. Some of you who listened to the song might wonder exactly how were a lot of those who were the guitar players responsible for playing all those weird psychedelic sections in the song. Well, let me just explain to you exactly what went down with those effects, you know, coming straight from the guy who was present during the recording session for the song, Terry Williams. And by the way, members of the first edition sang on the song, but they didn't really play on it. So basically, this is what Terry said about the song, you know, and the musicians and the guitar players that played on it. The opening of the song, you know, basically the way this went down is that the producer Post had Glenn Campbell do the center section solo first, but he didn't like it and he rejected it. And then the producer, again, Post, had Mike Deasy give it a try, and he liked his solo. And, you know, also, you know, Terry Williams, who has been playing the solo every night, you know, since before they recorded the song, he decided to give a go at it, and Post liked his solo too. So basically, the final cut, that really weird acid backwards phase fuzz tone wah-wah tremolo guitar solo in the middle of the song, that was both a combination of Mike Deasy's guitar playing and Terry Williams' guitar playing all intertwined together in this one really cool guitar solo in the middle of the song. So again, that was both a combination of Mike Deasy's playing and Terry Williams' playing to create that really weird acid rock solo, you know, in the middle of the song. And also, you know, Mike Deasy also added drones and a lot of other cool acoustic psychedelic bits at the end of the song. And basically, Now, if you're wondering what that weird intro is all about, that weird backwards, you know, guitar happening in the intro of the song, you know, what the producer of the song did is that Post basically took Glenn Campbell's solo, reversed a small section of it, and tacked it on to the beginning of the song. Which, you know, it's interesting because before they recorded Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In, before the song started out with the song's basic vocals, what condition my condition was in, and that's how the song started before Post added on that, tacked on Glenn Campbell's, you know, reversed, a small section of his reverse solo onto the beginning of the song. And that's how that sort of whole sort of beginning section, you know, that's how that section was created. Now, I don't know who played the marimba on the song. I don't know if it's a marimba or a vibraphone. I actually remember mentioned it's a xylophone in the last episode. Actually, it was either a marimba or a xylophone. The xylophone is too high pitched. Actually, it's not correct. It was either marimba or a xylophone. Marimba or a vibraphone. I'm not really sure exactly which one it was. It was either marimba or a vibraphone. I'm not really sure. I don't know who played that. I don't know who played the organ on the song. It was probably Leon Russell. Whoever played the marimba or vibraphone, it was probably Julius Wechter or Frank Capp or one of those, you know, LA percussion guys at the time. Maybe Emil Richards, one of those percussion guys. But again, definitely not one of the members of the first edition. But basically, that was the behind the scenes of the production on that song. You know, again, it was recorded at Valentine Recording Studios in Valley Village, California, with, you know, Jimmy Valentine engineered the record and Mike Post produced the session, and none of the members of the first edition played on it except for Terry Williams. Now, before we end this week's episode of the podcast, I wanted to give you guys a quick little recap on what happened with Kenny Rogers in the first edition after they released the song, because the song came out in the fall of 1967. And it actually made the charts in, you know, January, February 1968. It was a very big hit. It definitely was a top 40 hit for them. And yeah, you know, their first single didn't really do so well. And I think it was because more of a folk rock song, but their more psychedelic rock efforts with this song actually did pretty well. And in the beginning, it was kind of a slow mover up on the charts, but then once Kenny Rogers in the first edition made their first appearance in the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and if you don't know what that is, that was a big musical variety show back in the 60s, kind of like SNL right now, but except it's, you know, it was back in the 60s. When they made their appearance on that show, lip-syncing that song and doing all those weird psychedelic effects to go along with it, you know, for the visuals for their performance, that's when the song became a big hit. And yeah, so after that song came out, the group, like I said before, they decided to not stay in the psychedelic rock direction. After that song came out, they immediately went to country pop. And their first effort in country pop was an original song written by group member Mike Settle called But You Know I Love You. Now, the two other songs, the two big country pop crossover songs that did really well in the pop charts but also did pretty well in the country charts too, was Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town and Reuben James. Now, the thing is about these two songs to keep in mind is that they were very controversial. They tackled certain subject matter that wasn't necessarily the innocent love song factor of a lot of early 60s stuff. They actually tackled a lot of very much at the time controversial, you know, social issues. I mean, Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, which a lot of people thought was about a Vietnam War veteran coming home to his wife, who, you know, he was enraged with jealousy whenever, you know, his wife would leave him, actually was about a coming home World War II veteran. And again, very controversial for its time. And Reuben James was about a black man who was, you know, humiliated and constantly being ostracized by his white peers, but he actually raised a white boy. And again, very, very controversial at the time. And one song was written by Alex Harvey and Barry Etchers. That was Reuben James. And Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, that was written by country songwriter Mel Tillis and first recorded by Johnny Darrell as kind of a country song in 1967 before Kenny Rogers in the first edition covered it. And yeah, so a couple other things happened with this band after they released Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Is In. There was a couple personnel changes. Selma Camacho left the band. sometime in 1969, and she was replaced by Mary Arnold. And Mike Settle also left the group in around that same time, and he was replaced by Kim Bassey. And Terry Williams and Kenny Rogers essentially became like took the reins and became like the leaders of the band, really. I mean, Kenny Rogers was picking all the songs, and Terry Williams was doing all the arrangements. And also, Mickey Jones was starting to have a lot of health problems at the time, and he was also starting to, become a lot less reliable for the band. And all this happened when they were really at the height of their career. I mean, they were just having hit after hit after hit. I mean, after Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, Reuben James, which came out after But You Know I Love You, I mean, they had Some Things Burning and Tell It All, Brother, and all these really, really big songs all within that 1969-1970 period. And they were really, really doing well in the pop charts. But really, I think Kenny Rogers was destined to be a country star. That's kind of what he really wanted to do because, because the first edition was going down that country pop realm, they were going down that route. That's probably why he decided to really go country pop full way into the late 70s with Lucille and The Gambler and all those really big songs that he recorded at that time, in the late 70s, which became huge on the country charts and as well as the pop charts. So I feel like that really made him want to do that because the way the first edition was going at that time. Also, a quick little recap on what happened with psychedelic rock in the late 60s, because just a quick little FYI, some of you might be aware of this, some of you might not. The whole thing about psychedelic rock was that it was just a fad, really. It didn't really last too long. I mean, the height of the genre was definitely 1967 to 1968. But by 69, it felt like the genre was starting to taper off and kind of fall on the wayside, which is funny to say that because that was when the Woodstock Festival happened in the summer of 1969, and that's when a lot of people were doing drugs. But, I mean, I felt like by 69, I felt like the genre was starting to taper off because it kind of felt like people were starting to realize the dangerous consequences of even doing psychedelic drugs. And, when people realized that psychedelic drugs was tied to psychedelic rock, the popularity of that genre of music definitely declined by a lot. And this was in 1969. So again, this was definitely, marked the end of that specific genre of music. And yeah, and just a quick little recap on Kenny Rogers in the first edition. If you've never heard of this band, it was Kenny Rogers' first group that he did before he had a huge solo career in country, country pop in the late 70s. Early 80s, but the main thing to remember about this band is that they had a lot of variety. I mean, in the beginning, they weren't really settled on just being a psychedelic rock band, but really, they had four really good lead singers: Mike Settle, Terry Williams, Thelma Camacho, and Kenny Rogers, and they could all do very different genres of music. They could do folk, they can do rock, they can do pop, they can do country. They can do all sorts of stuff, and a lot of that showed in a lot of their later albums. And a lot of, that's basically, what made the first edition so unique was because they could just tackle so many different genres of music, and they were all really good singers, lead singers. So they can do lead vocals on pretty much any song. And also, here's a quick little piece of trivia for you. This is actually kind of cool. I talked about how the song kind of sounds like a Jimi Hendrix song. Well, Jimi Hendrix has approached Kenny Rogers, and I've told him this is one of his favorite songs. I'm not even joking. Yes. Jimi Hendrix has approached Kenny Rogers and says, "Look, man, I love this song. I love the production on it. I love the guitar effects on it. I love the lead guitar playing on it. It's one of my favorite songs." And that is so true. I mean, I'm not even joking. Literally, he told Kenny Rogers that this was one of his favorite songs. Now, how is that for a cool connection right there? And just one more thing about the band before I end this podcast. If you're wondering exactly why they left the New Christian Minstrels, well, I mentioned earlier that they were kind of getting sifted by them. Well, it's also because the group, the New Christian Minstrels, wouldn't allow them to record their own songs. And so because of that, they were pretty much trying to avoid paying the members of that group royalties. And that's the main reason as to why You know, Terry Williams, Mike Settle, and Kenny Rogers left the band, the New Christian Minstrels, and formed their own group, the First Edition. So that concludes part two of episode number 107 of my 60 Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you found out some really cool and interesting facts about this band, the First Edition, and you never knew anything about it, but you knew about Kenny Rogers, and you're like, wow, this was his band before he became like a big country pop star, before he did all those commercials where he was like the gambler. I mean, you know, if you found out some really cool and interesting facts about this band, you never knew anything about them, and you're just shocked that this is Kenny Rogers' band before he became big, you can email me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And I just want to remind you guys, my new and improved website is out. You can click the link to that in the description of this episode of this podcast, but it's under my new URL, the same URL, but new website, samwilliamsmusic.net. There you'll be able to stream all my podcasts from this episode onto the first episode I did. So you'll be able to listen to all of them right then and there. And it's cool because if you don't have, like I mentioned before last week, if you don't have an account with any major podcast listening platform like Apple or Spotify or whatever, you know, you can basically listen to my entire podcast entirely for free on my website, which is really cool. I'm very happy that Hooshka kind of made that for me. But yeah, my distributor, you know, which I use to get my podcast on all the platforms. But yeah, so also as per usual, things you can check out, that the links to them are in the description of this episode of this podcast, are my YouTube and Spotify playlists for this podcast, where you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some ones I've mentioned in interview episodes. And as per usual, this should give you an idea for what kind of songs I should talk about on my show, you know, or this should give you an idea for the kind of music I talk about specifically on my podcast. And if this gives you any ideas for any kind of songs to talk about next on my show that I haven't yet, please email those ideas to me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. Also, another thing you can check out, you know, is the official Redbubble store for this podcast. You'll be able to find all these really cool merch items with my very own specific Millennial Throwback Machine logo for this podcast. And it's basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode and keep on chucking tie-dye font with me and my podcast on the bottom, plus a bunch of really cool merch items that are all made, you know, by Redbubble, which is really cool. And we'll love it if you guys could, you know, go on there and check it out and let me know what you think of the logo plus, you know, the price of each item in the store. And if you'd like to buy something, that'd be really cool. I'd appreciate that. And if you do decide to buy something, please email me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies, or you can just let me know what you think of the logo itself and the price of each item in the store. I'd really appreciate that as well. But yeah, so again, so this is kind of my entry into the psychedelic rock field, for this podcast. I might do it again, but if you don't really know too much about the genre, or if you know about other songs from this genre, like The Doors, like the ones by Doors, Jefferson Airplane, and, you know, Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead, but you want to check out another song within this genre that wasn't in that specific, that wasn't done by any of those bands, this would be a good entry into that. But yeah, so I'm Sam Williams, and thank you again for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please, keep things groovy.